Well, hello all, and welcome to the teleclass, Selecting Microbicidal Chemicals for Infection Control, Buyer Beware. My name is Paul Weber, and normally I would welcome you on behalf of my colleague and the co-founder of Teleclass Education, Dr. Syed Sattar, but today he is here to bring those greetings himself. The name Syed Sattar is known worldwide and respected just as broadly. As you see on the title slide, Dr. Sattar is Professor Emeritus at the University of Ottawa Faculty of Medicine, and he is the founder and director of the Center for Research on Environmental Microbiology. He and his colleagues developed the test methodology for disinfectants that's called the quantitative carrier test. This is a methodology that's used as the gold standard, really, in many countries. He's written textbook chapters. He's been published in more peer-reviewed articles than I could possibly mention. He has given keynote lectures at, I think, just about every large national and international conference, something that has taken him around the globe several times over. He has mentored many of today's top research researchers, and of course, he has an instrumental role in the success of this Teleclass Education Lecture Series. He's a very humble man with extraordinary influence, and I am delighted to and honored to be able to call him my friend. From the University of Ottawa, to give the teleclass Selecting Microbicidal Chemicals for Infection Control, I give you the one and absolute only Dr. Syed Sattar. Dr. Sattar.
Thank you, Paul. The first slide is what I'm starting out with. Hello, everyone. This is my fourth lecture in the teleclass series, and this one, again, will give you an academic's perspective on preventing and controlling the spread of infection in healthcare settings using chemicals as microbicides. When the title says, Buyer Beware, please don't automatically regard that as industry bashing. Far from it. Instead, I hope to present to you a much broader perspective on the issues relating to microbicide use by being an equal opportunity critic of all major players in this arena. I will be referring to several studies in my presentation, and I'll be happy to provide a reading list through the Weber Training website. The next slide, please. I thank Paul Weber for inviting me back and also for doing such a superb job of coordinating the teleclasses around the globe. Even though he very generously gives me and my center much credit for the success of the teleclasses, in reality, our contribution is minimal. I'm most grateful to him for his selfless efforts in coordinating these teleclasses, and I can tell you that he's not in it for the money. He's among those rare individuals who do things based mainly on passion and altruistic ideals. By the way, Paul, happy birthday and many happy returns. I also must thank the students and staff of my research center whose hard work makes it possible for me to present our exciting findings. Next slide, please. Lest you forget, microbial pathogens continue to exert a heavy toll on our health and economy. Even today, they kill some 17 million humans per year. This accounts for nearly 30% of all fatalities with an identified cause. This is, of course, a gross underestimation of the impact of infectious agents because in many cases the exact cause of death is not or cannot be determined. Moreover, microbes are now suspected to play a key role in the etiology of cardiovascular and neurological diseases, as well as in the causation of cancer and other common chronic conditions such as arthritis. Such mounting evidence means that infectious agents are responsible for a much greater share of the recorded fatalities. Contrary to popular belief, ongoing societal changes are further increasing our exposure and vulnerability to many potentially harmful microbes. Here are some examples. Humans, as well as goods, are moving around the globe at ever faster. About 150 years ago, it took one full year to circumnavigate the globe, but now we can do it in less than a day. Such jet setting allows infectious agents to hitch a ride on infected individuals or animals while still in the incubation or pre-symptomatic phase. This is how the SARS virus managed to spread. Many articles of food are often shipped refrigerated or frozen, and this inadvertently also prolongs the viability of any pathogens that they may carry. This is how hepatitis A virus and cyclospora entered Canada and the United States through imported berries. Life expectancy in industrialized countries in particular has increased substantially in the past few decades. In Canada, it was about 60 years in the early 1920s, but now it is already over 80 years on an average. The corresponding figures for the U.S. are about 3 years lower. Immunosuppression due to AIDS, cancer therapy, and organ transplantation renders us highly vulnerable to attack by many opportunistic pathogens. These factors, along with still raging antibiotic resistance, are reviving interest in environmental control. And as you may already realize, microbicides are the backbone of any successful environmental control program. With the wider use of microbicides, there is corresponding increase in the concerns on the safety of many of the chemicals, their testing, label claims, and how such products are regulated for sale. Next slide, please. This slide poses questions for the discussion to come. Why and where do we need microbicidal chemicals? What specific safety concerns do they pose? How does their testing impact the label claims? In view of the identified concerns, what should a buyer user look for in the products they wish to use? And how then can a user help in correcting the situation? Next slide, please. As shown in this diagram, we rely on microbicides directly or indirectly in many aspects of our lives. This clearly means that stopping their use would not be feasible in the foreseeable future, particularly in view of the aforementioned widening negative impact of microbes on our health and economy. Manufacture and sale of disinfectants and sanitizers is big business in North America. In the U.S. alone, over 2,500 million pounds of chlorine and hypochlorites are used every year for the disinfection of potable and recreational waters, as well as wastewater. Another 65 million pounds of other microbicides are used annually as disinfectants and sanitizers, accounting for 20% of all specialty biocides used. Please also note that nearly 60% of all registered microbicides are marketed to control nosocomial pathogens. Next slide, please. I just said that we rely quite heavily on microbicides for infection control. Interestingly, this reliance is based on perceived benefits and not on concrete scientific evidence. This is simply because any such assessment would be dogged by variables too numerous to be handled by currently available tools. Paradoxically, mistakes have proven helpful in that using the wrong product or higher than recommended dilution for a given formulation has resulted in cross-contamination and spread of nosocomial pathogens. Rigorous laboratory-based studies have clearly proven that the use of appropriate environmental surface and medical device disinfectant and hand antiseptics can interrupt the spread of pathogens. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration demands evidence of direct benefit from the use of antimicrobial hand wash and hand rub agents before granting them drug identification numbers. Next slide, please. Now let's review the specific concerns as listed on this slide. The issue of safety to humans and the environment is front and center in any discussion on microbicidal chemicals. If safety is such an important issue, what are we doing about it? I will soon summarize my understanding of what is being done. How good are the methods for testing the microbicidal activities of chemicals? Many of you may not regard this as a significant point, but just remember that the label claims that whatever product to use is only as good and reliable as the test methods employed to generate it. In other words, flawed test methods make for unreliable and potentially dangerous label claims. Many such methods in wise use today simply do not reflect the field conditions where microbicides are normally used. This major disconnect has remained unquestioned for many years now. As a buyer and user, you should recognize this in making any purchasing decisions. Here, may I be so bold as to suggest that many of the identified problems with microbicides are, to a large extent, due to the fault of end users, such as infection control practitioners or ICPs. If this is so, what can ICPs do to alleviate the problem? Next slide, please. I'm happy to say that the awareness on the safety issues is now wider than ever. This gives it the needed momentum for a change for the better. The basic premise is that anything that can kill microorganisms cannot be altogether safe for higher life forms. The old adage, dose makes the poison, which is ascribed to the Swiss physician Paracelsus, is certainly applicable to many types of chemicals. However, it does not quite cover those synthetic chemicals which may be deleterious even at very low doses. Also, that many synthetic microbicides have not been around long enough to allow our bodies to evolve effective ways of dealing with them. We should also note that toxicity assessments on chemicals are currently conducted on one chemical at a time, and findings of such studies then form the basis for exposure limits. But we now know that exposure to two or more environmental chemicals, each at its otherwise acceptably low dosage, can cause detectable damage. This is exemplified by the recent findings of Hayes and his colleagues at the University of California, Berkeley. While simultaneous or sequential exposure of humans to low levels of a variety of environmental chemicals must commonly occur in industrialized societies, we don't yet have the acumen to decipher its impact on human health. For example, current regulations on exposure limits for workplace safety are based on test data with individual chemicals, because assessing the human health impact of exposure to low doses of multiple chemicals can be immensely complicated. We could either devote our meager resources to developing the means to further investigate this problem, or simply reduce the loading of the environment with potentially dangerous or harmful chemicals. I believe that the use of persistent synthetic chemicals as microbicides is in general a bad idea, because what goes around comes around. Please note that persistent chemicals end up in the waste stream and eventually in our receiving water in concentrations that you may think too low to be of much concern. In fact, many such chemicals become biomagnified in the food chain, either in their original form or as harmful byproducts. It is now being realized that concentrations of these chemicals, once considered to be too low to be of concern, can indeed be potentially harmful. One example of such chemicals is that which can mimic endocrine hormones and interfere with gender differentiation, especially in the very young. As a result, these substances are called gender bender chemicals because they can confuse the body during the crucial phase of gender differentiation. Affected animals simply cannot procreate, resulting in a profound impact on their survival as a species. Recent studies by Weldhorn et al. In Canada indicate that triclosan, a widely used microbicide, can interfere with the activity of the thyroid gland. There are also some emerging worries on the combined health impact of sequential or simultaneous exposure to low levels of environmental chemicals and infectious agents. It appears that while the chemical and the infectious agent may be somewhat innocuous on their own, they can potentiate each other's action, leading to more serious consequences. I have coined the self-explanatory term chembioction to describe this phenomenon and recently written a review on the subject. Next slide, please. I often talk about the book Our Stolen Future by Theo Kohlberg. Even though it is now nearly 10 years old, its impact on our thinking continues to increase as it has catalyzed major initiatives to deal with the harmful effects of low levels of environmental chemicals. Canadian and U.S. governments have now programs to identify and eliminate hormone-disrupting chemicals. One recent example of this is the restriction on the use of bisphenol A, Canada being the first country to do so. In Europe, the Biocidal Products Directive of 1998 places the onus on the makers of microbicides to prove their human and environmental safety. If that cannot be done, those chemicals will be prohibited from sale. The United Nations Environment Program now coordinates a systematic analysis of the health impact of persistent organic chemicals, or POPs, P-O-Ps. Next slide, please. The past few years have seen a huge upsurge of interest in green products and technologies. To many, this may appear to have happened rather suddenly, but in reality, it had an incubation period of at least 20 years. I believe that this trend is now here to stay, and it now has a strong political backing. As mentioned before, the use of many environmental chemicals is now restricted and others are under review. As an aside, not too long ago, it would have been difficult to believe that many jurisdictions would ban the use of pesticides on domestic lawns. This is now reality, and many unsafe microbicidal chemicals cannot be too far behind. But if microbicidal chemicals have an important role to play, how do we substitute the ones that may be phased out or restricted? In my view, the future is with chemical oxidizers, ideally those which are non-halogenated. As shown here, the list of such chemicals is quite limited. Also, materials compatibility of oxidizers in general still remains to be properly tamed, and the pungent smell of some is an impediment to their wider use. Next slide, please. This slide lists the most important requirements for green products or processes. Reducing the waste and energy consumption while producing safer chemicals. And B, the starting materials to come from a bio-based economy, meaning, for example, avoidance of materials based on fossil fuels or other non-renewable resources. Whenever one mentions green, formulations based on all natural substances enter the picture. My plea here is to avoid being swayed by such labels, because all natural does not necessarily mean something that is fast-acting and broad-spectrum enough to be relevant for healthcare settings in particular. For example, vinegar, which is about 6% acetic acid, can be highly effective against Pseudomonas aeruginosa and acid-sensitive rhinoviruses, but not much else. Formulations based on herbal extracts are effective only against easy-to-kill vegetative bacteria while requiring a contact time of several minutes to do so. Here, one also must make a clear distinction between cleaning and disinfection. The requirements for general cleaning may be much easier to meet, and perhaps many all-natural products would perform well in that regard. Therefore, please use an informed judgment in deciding if products based on all natural ingredients will really suit your needs. Next slide, please. In 1998, Anastas and Warner compiled a list of 12 principles for green chemistry. I have listed here only those four that relate directly to microbicides. Number one, design chemicals and products that are fully effective with little or no toxicity. This presents a major challenge to the industry, and they must face it head-on if they are to remain competitive with green products. Number two, use safe solvents and reaction conditions. Here again, the emphasis is away from petroleum-based chemicals. Number three, design chemicals and products to degrade after use so that they do not accumulate. This obviously refers to the dangers with persistent chemicals mentioned above. Number four, minimize potential accidents such as explosions, fires, and releases to the environment. This clearly relates to safe transport, storage, handling, and disposal of chemicals. As far as I know, regulators in North America now subscribe to the principles stated here and will want to see them implemented soon by the industry. Next slide, please. Here are some examples of independent and government-sponsored bodies which are actively promoting green products and procedures. The increasing number of such organizations is also a strong indicator of the mounting interest in the use of safer chemicals. There is, of course, a difference in the areas of emphasis of these organizations. Some focus almost entirely on indoor air quality, while others have a much broader mandate. Next slide, please. This is a good example of how politicians are definitely involved in the green movement. The state of Massachusetts passed an act last year mandating the use of safer chemicals in all public settings. The chemicals referred to here include disinfectants. I believe that such a move on the part of an influential state government is most likely to induce others to follow suit. Next slide, please. I'm fully aware of the impact that any talk of microbicide testing has on infection control practitioners. On any such mention, their eyes glaze over and they begin to yawn out of boredom. Well, I hope you will maintain at least a passing interest in what I'm about to say, because it does have a profound impact on what you use for disinfection. Simply stated, a product label claims for microbicidal activity are only as good as the method used to generate them. In other words, using a weak or flawed test protocol makes for weaker or potentially misleading claims. You should also know at this stage that certain of the commonly used test methods are indeed flawed and in some ways favor the formulations to be tested. I have been quite critical of the situation for a number of years and also devoted much effort to bringing about corrective action. I am happy to say that efforts are indeed changing things for the better. Here, I also must note that microbicide manufacturers are not solely responsible for the flawed test method and questionable label claims based on them. The blame must be shared by regulators, standard-setting organizations, researchers, as well as end users. Regulators are constrained by government laws, which are often antiquated and difficult to change, even in the face of newer knowledge and better scientific evidence. They also will not allow manufacturers the freedom to submit microbicidal efficacy data from better test protocols simply because the system does not permit it. Standard-setting organizations, which are in the business of developing scientifically valid and robust test protocol, are often top-heavy with representatives from the private sector and also lack sufficient participation from government regulators and academics. Researchers from universities simply do not regard this endeavor as sexy enough for participation, nor is it easy to generate funding to pursue this as a viable field of research. As mentioned before, end users such as infection control practitioners either have more pressing priorities or do not have the training or background to make a meaningful contribution to this field. all this together has perpetuated the problem for far too long. But what are the problems with the test methods and their impact on the data generated using them? Number one, quite often it is not possible to use the actual pathogen to test microbicides against it. This may be due to our inability to culture it in the laboratory or the high safety level needed to handle it. This requires the use of suitable surrogate organisms to generate efficacy data, and the use of an inappropriate surrogate can either overestimate or underestimate the product's potency. Number two, in certain cases, distilled water is used at the diluent for products requiring dilution in water to prepare their in-use dilution. First of all, this is not clearly stated on the label, and equally importantly, not many users would dilute their microbicides in distilled water. Moreover, there is evidence that the low levels of impurities in tap water may be sufficient to interfere with the microbicidal action of certain marginal products. Number three, pathogens are discharged from infected cases always suspended in one type of body fluid or another. That level of organic or inorganic material shields the pathogen from environmental stresses and also creates a demand on any microbicide applied to inactivate them. Therefore, testing of microbicides must be conducted with a sufficient level of soil loading to reflect the field conditions they may encounter. This is not the case in many current test protocols, resulting in an overestimation of a product's microbicidal potential. Number four, the label claims for contact time for microbicidal activity is often too long in relation to the normal field application of environmental surface disinfectant. This has been one of my main beefs for a long time. The regulators in Canada have started to allow for shorter contact time, but it's still not the case in other jurisdictions. Many users must push for products with much shorter contact times for a better confidence in their field use. Number five, the type of design and material for the carriers are another factor. Carriers unsuited to microbicide testing cannot be loaded with known volumes of the challenge organism, nor can they be exposed to relatively small volumes of the test microbicide. This does not allow for proper quantitation of the microbicidal activity, and the tested formulation will potentially be overestimated for its activity by exposing the carriers to much larger than normal volumes of the product. In fairness to manufacturers, the current lack of harmonized test requirements for microbicidal products makes for an expensive and frustrating exercise in product development. Testing with completely different types of methods must be carried out to meet wide variations in regulatory requirements and product performance criteria. This concern is being addressed at an international level by the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, which has all 30 industrialized countries as its members. Next slide, please. Unfortunately, there is still a strong tendency to claim microbicidal activity against the bug of the week. Manufacturers plead innocent in this matter by saying that they are essentially forced to make those claims by their customers. I tend to believe that, and thus assign the blame on those end users who should know better. As an example of exaggerated claims, many environmental surface disinfectants claim activity against Clostridium difficile, even though the testing was done using the easy-to-kill vegetative form of that pathogen and not its harder-to-kill and more relevant spores. An end user may not readily appreciate this disparity and inadvertently end up by spreading the contamination over a wider area during the process of cleaning and disinfection. Only recently has the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency initiated action to correct the situation. As far as I know, Canada does not accept data based on activity against the vegetative form of Clostridium difficile. Next slide, please. Unless you're working with a known type of pathogen in a laboratory, the target pathogen or pathogens under most field conditions are unknown during routine decontamination of environmental surfaces. In view of this, why should one use a microbicidal product which claims activity against relatively fragile vegetative bacteria? Such practices may generate a false sense of security while loading the environment with potentially damaging chemicals. What we need are faster-acting products with a reasonably broad spectrum of microbicidal activity. The focus on bactericidal activity was perhaps justified at a time when they were easier, cheaper, and safer to work with as compared to viruses and fungi. But we now know how significant viruses and fungi are as nosocomial pathogens. Thus, environmental surface disinfectants must have demonstrated activity against those classes of pathogens as well. Next slide, please. Another major issue in evaluation of environmental surface disinfectants in particular is that the volumes used in laboratory tests just do not reflect field applications. Most such products are applied with a pre-wetted wiper or wiped after spraying the surface with a liquid or foam. In either case, the volume of the microbicide in contact with the target surface is minuscule as compared to the volumes used in actual test protocols. This can seriously compromise the microbicidal activity of the product used in combination with very short contact times before the product would evaporate. Our recent findings are summarized in the table here. When a liquid was applied on formica or stainless steel using a wet piece of cloth without squeezing to remove excess liquid, no more than 2 microliters of the liquid covered every square centimeter. When the cloth was squeezed before wiping, the volume of liquid per square centimeter was no more than 0.3 microliters. This is well below the surface area volume used in any current accepted test method for microbicidal activity. Next slide, please. I simply cannot let an opportunity like this pass without reminding you about what one should look for in a microbicide. This list gets shorter or longer depending on the audience I'm addressing. The list is self-explanatory, and I will not repeat what it already is written on the slide, except to remind you that nothing can be totally safe and that risk from chemicals can be substantially reduced by better awareness, proper training, correct application method, and also by setting the right product or by selecting the right product for the job at hand. Next slide, please. The demand for microbicides is increasing because of emerging and re-emerging pathogens, societal changes that are increasing our vulnerability and exposure to pathogens, and due to the fact that treatment options with drugs such as antibiotics are getting narrower by the day. The pressure for regional and global harmonization of test methods and registration requirements is also increasing. More and more treated articles, items with chemically bound microbicides are being marketed. I regard many of those as questionable in value, with potential for long-term harm in terms of resistance to microbicides. The issue of the potential of microbicides to make pathogens cross-resistant to antibiotics will soon need to be settled one way or the other with proper field studies. Current evidence is based mostly on laboratory tests. We urgently need better methods for testing the microbicidal activity of chemicals and also to better assess their activity in the field. Next slide, please. It is imperative that infection control practitioners themselves take their role seriously in improving the situation. This they can do by, number one, not asking manufacturers and suppliers for irrelevant label claims on microbicides. I realize that they are on the front lines and must protect themselves and their patients in situations such as the SARS episode. But environmental surface disinfectants cannot be relied upon to provide protection against infection, which spread by other means, such as via the air. Number two, demanding safer products with more user-friendly labels. This is important for workplace safety for themselves and their co-workers to avoid unnecessary mistake in the use, storage, and disposal of microbicidal chemicals. Number three, convincing materials managers to take factors other than price alone in choosing microbicidal products. Number four, promptly reporting failures and problems in microbicide use, because such situations can be highly beneficial in preventing more serious mistakes later. Number five, ensuring proper and ongoing training of housekeeping staff on the use of microbicide. This is a vital issue because staff with inadequate training can be the weak link in the chain of infection prevention and control. Number six, urging government regulators to update the system for registering microbicides. We are all told to look for the drug identification number when selecting microbicides to give us the confidence that the information on microbicidal activity and safety of the formulation has been critically reviewed prior to granting the registration. As mentioned before, this is not necessarily true when you realize that the product registration process in itself depends on flawed test methodology and seriously outdated criteria. Next slide, please. It is extremely important to note that many have quite unrealistic expectations from microbicides. In healthcare and other settings, a pathogen may spread by means where the best available microbicide cannot prevent its spread simply because that pathogen is not amenable to environmental control. Microbicides are already under greater and greater scrutiny, and this trend is likely to get even more stringent. This would mean that chemicals that you now rely upon may become unavailable for concerns based on toxicity, limited activity, and potential for environmental damage. Therefore, antimicrobial activity will become only one component in their availability and use. A truly concerted effort is needed on the part of all parties concerned to address the issues identified here. A recent report, that is April 2008, from the U.S. General Accountability Office, is highly critical of the key agencies responsible for controlling healthcare-associated infections. In all this, end users are the most critical players because they represent the true consumer power. Many of you may have already heard certain aspects of this afternoon's presentation. I will keep reiterating the same points till I see clear evidence for improvement. On my part, I actively look for and collaborate with those companies which are genuinely desirous of making a change for the better. While this is very important, our efforts are doomed to fail without the involvement and cooperation of end users and regulators alike. Healthcare-associated infections continue to be a serious problem in North America, and the changing profile in nosocomial pathogen continues to present newer challenges. Noroviruses and Clostridium difficile are just two examples here. Such harder-to-kill pathogens are putting increasing demands on microbicidal chemicals while they are mounting concern on the effectiveness and safety of such chemicals. Hopefully, this presentation has sensitized you to several of the concerns. In closing, I must note that we do live better with chemistry. As a result, we have become highly dependent on many types of chemicals in our daily life, but we simply don't know when to draw the line and tend to go hog wild with any good thing and turn it into a curse. Let's do not do this with microbicides. Thank you and good day.
Dr. Starr, thank you very much. It's certainly true that when something good comes along, as you say, turn it into a curse by overusing it and abusing it. Thank you for this very interesting teleclass. I have a couple of questions for you before I open the line for questions. We have lots of time for them. The proliferation of microfiber cloths these days for cleaning on surfaces, floors, and so on, for use in dry cleaning and wet, but with only water. What's your opinion on the use of microfiber in lieu of biocides?
Good question, Paul. This is an area that is attracting a lot of attention, but unfortunately at this stage, I don't know of any really good studies to have produced data to be able to answer that question appropriately. We have done some limited work with microfibers, and we have used them to wipe contaminated surfaces, either with spores or with virus or vegetative bacteria, when they were wetted with just plain water, or used completely dry, or wetted with environmental surface disinfectants. And we do see, and of course the comparison was run with cotton fabrics or fabrics mixed with cotton and polyester, for example. We do see a better activity with microfiber-based fabrics. We also have noted that such fabrics, when they pick up contamination, donate the contamination less effectively or less generously than do cotton mixed with the synthetic fibers. So that means that when you're cleaning up contaminated surfaces, you may indeed be removing the contamination better while not transferring it to other clean surfaces during the process of wiping. We are, as we speak, doing another bigger study to be able to answer this question, and I am, in fact, hoping to be able to make a more formal presentation on the topic sometime in November this year.
Good. I'd be glad to hear more of that. I'm sure we all will. Now, there's a move toward fogging of intensive care rooms or patient rooms, and I understand some places are even looking at ozone again. Do you have any comment on the issues of using a gas or a fogging agent or ozone?
Yes, we again have some of our own experience in that regard. In terms of the chemicals that are used for that purpose, the selection that is available is rather limited. You can do this with hydrogen peroxide, you can do it with chlorine dioxide, and also with ozone. They all have strengths and weaknesses, but one common problem with all these chemicals, because they're all strong oxidizing agents, is that they can be corrosive or not entirely compatible with certain sensitive materials. Therefore, if such fogging is to be carried out, one has to be very careful about removing or protecting expensive yet sensitive materials, and that in fact is done in many cases. The effectiveness of achieving a thorough disinfection of such premises depends on the concentration and the contact time, and also in some operations or certain processes, the relative humidity has to be high enough, say around 70%, for that formulation to work optimally. The experience of using such fogging agents is accumulating very rapidly. I have just heard two presentations about 2 weeks ago where a whole hospital had to be fumigated to rid of fungal contamination. In another case, a building and a barn had to be fumigated because they were suspected contamination with spores of Bacillus anthracis or the anthrax spores. So those situations are teaching us many, many lessons, and at the same time pointing out the deficiencies in these processes. So chlorine dioxide and hydrogen peroxide are now more extensively used, and there are pieces of equipment that are available from two or three different manufacturers. But ozone is kind of staging a comeback, but I'm still not entirely sure of the compatibility of, say, rubbers and other kinds of plastics with ozone if ozonation is used repeatedly in indoor settings. For example, if you want to do it in a dentist's clinic, people have noticed that the expensive upholstery and leather that is used on those chairs begin to crumble because of the contact with ozone.
And of course, any fancy plants or flowers would be completely dead.
Yeah, and soft metals such as brass and copper would also not withstand such exposure to any of these strong oxidizers.
Dr. Starr, as a public health inspector, we would have to enforce use of microbicides in, for example, personal service settings. And one of my biggest problems with the operators usually is that they tend to hang their hat on the term tuberculicidal and use that as a kind of a gold standard for what they might consider to be a high-level disinfectant. I was wondering, wouldn't the term mycobactericidal be a little more appropriate, and if there was any consideration being given to either adjusting that terminology or changing that?
Yes. Hi, Christian. Nice to hear from you. Yeah, this is something which has been discussed, and I have written about this in my publications. Certainly, the use of the term tuberculoside is way outdated, and it should be replaced with mycobactericide or mycobactericidal activity. And again, for those who may not know this, the use of the term tuberculocidal for certain types of environmental surface disinfectants was introduced in the U.S. because at that time, working with hepatitis B virus was not possible or to be able to claim activity against hepatitis B virus. So they assume that anything that would kill tubercle bacteria would also be effective against hepatitis B virus. Well, we now know much more about hepatitis B virus, and that there are now surrogates available to test activity against hepatitis B virus. But it has kind of remained as an indicator of activity over these years. But term tuberculoside should be phased out as soon as possible, because tuberculosis normally does not spread through contaminated environmental surfaces, whereas other types of mycobacteria can.
And one presumes that a chemical is a mycobactericide if it says it's a tuberculicidal product?
Yes, because the types of bacteria that are used in either calling it a tuberculicide or a mycobactericide are very similar. In fact, one type of surrogate organism that is used to generate data for tuberculicidal activity is not a particularly safe organism to work with. It's a very temperamental organism. It also requires many, many, many weeks of being able to complete a test. And this is a good example of what I was referring to in terms of using inappropriate surrogates for such testing.
Thank you for that comment, Dr. Sitar, related to sales reps who come to your office and claim things it'll kill MRSA, like I should jump up and down and be excited by that. When I remember a few years ago, where you had said that disinfectant, if any resistance to disinfectant or antibiotics does not translate into disinfectant resistance. So thanks again for reiterating that. But my question was related to what Paul had asked earlier about the disinfectant fogging. and there is one product out there that claims sterilization of a room. How do you do a claim of sterilizing an environment like an OR or a patient room or an ICU, whatever? How are they able to make a claim like we can sterilize a room?
No, this is a good example of very loose use of terminology, Jackie. And again, I have been carrying on this crusade with the use of the term sterilant for liquid chemicals. It simply cannot be validated. There is just no easy way to be able to do that. And also that such things are neither wrapped in a sterile packaging, nor do they remain sterile after the process is complete. So I would be very leery about the use of the term sterilize a given room or a given ward or a premises of that kind. I think it's simply a matter of educating people to make them realize that the term sterile or sterilization is an absolute term that must be validated through internationally accepted means before that term can be used for a process or a piece of equipment or whatever. And this simply cannot be done.
Mrs. Starr, what do you think about all the products out there among the public that are now containing disinfectant agents? I've had even people come to me with pens that contain a disinfectant, supposedly, and I'm not sure what the purpose of all that is. Toys, shower curtains, shoes, mats, countertops. How does that impact the green that we're trying to achieve and all those things in kids' toys and they're chewing on it? And do you have any comments on that?
I do, and I have some strong views about it. And this is what I was referring to in terms of treated articles in my presentation earlier. I feel quite uncomfortable about the proliferation of these so-called treated items. There are two reasons for this. One is that their testing, or at least the test methods that are available to declare them as effective, has some problems with it because it certainly overestimates their microbicidal activity. The other issue is that whether it is chemically bound or not, the microbicide does get released over time. And there again, this chronic low-level release of microbicidal agents is a surefire way of selecting for microbicide-resistant bacteria or viruses or fungi, whatever. So I think, and this is in the light of no validated benefit from the use of such products. So I am, in fact, discouraging their use. The only time they might be helpful is when, say, you make a fabric which is made into, say, a shirt to protect from or reduce body odor. Now, what happens there is that when there is perspiration, that moisture can activate the microbicidal activity and keep bacterial growth from getting to the stage where it could be a problem. But other than that, on dry surfaces, the microbicidal activity is virtually not there. There are products now registered with the EPA which are made into socks to counter, again, foot odor and also perhaps reduce the risk of athlete's foot. Perhaps there is some justification, but this industry, again, is burgeoning in a way which makes me feel rather uncomfortable about it.
You really can't avoid the marketing for disinfectants for domestic use, can you? It's ubiquitous, really.
It is ubiquitous, and I think this is where regulators have to put their foot down. And again, as an academic, I keep saying that I keep my mind open. But so far, I haven't seen evidence where the use of such products does cut down on the spread of infections while eliminating or making the risk of the use of these chemicals a non-issue. And that I don't have the evidence for.
I'm curious about one thing that's that always kind of drives me a little nuts is antibacterial claims on hand soaps, for example, and things like that. Now, I'm wondering, seeing that it's been somewhat proven that antibacterial soaps are not very effective, I'm wondering, what is it, how does an industry or a commercial enterprise or whoever, how do they get the term antibacterial on a product? What would they have to prove to get that done?
Well, you can carry out tests in the laboratory. There are certain standard methods to be able to do that. But whether they mean anything in terms of their ability to cut down on the spread of infections through hands remains questionable. If you're talking about soaps, I've always maintained that a soap with an antimicrobial or antibacterial ingredient is really not necessary if you wash your hands properly and regularly with just plain soap and water and dry them well. Now, the waterless rubs, such as those based on a certain percentage of ethanol, have a certain use because they can be carried in places where the hand washing may not be available, and also that they have fairly rapid and broad spectrum activity, and if they're used between hand washings, they have a certain role to play in reducing the level of contamination on hands.
We're getting more products with metal impregnation of some sort, silver and copper particularly. Do you have a comment on the usefulness of those?
Again, copper is not as common, or perhaps it is common more in certain kinds of swimming pool water disinfection processes. But silver is attracting a lot of attention. The problem with silver is that it may work against bacteria when they are metabolizing, because silver has to get to certain targets before it can produce a bacteriostatic or bactericidal action. It would be virtually useless against many types of viruses, and also silver is rather slow acting. So if you're incorporating silver into a bandage to be put on a wound to protect it from infection, I think that that may be a good way to go about it. But if you're using a chemical to wipe a surface, such as a tabletop or a medical device, then I'm not so sure of the usefulness of that.
So thank you all for joining us today. And Dr. Sitara, thank you again for a really exciting teleclass and a great discussion afterward. You never cease to amaze at how clear and concise and helpful your answers can be. Thank you very much for that.
Thank you. Thank you, Paul. Thank you for the listeners.
To everyone, we will talk to you again very soon. Goodbye.